Okay, I'm going to start with the usual short recitation of the four-line prayer of taking refuge in the Buddha as the teacher, the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as the community. And you can join in if it's a prayer with which you are familiar, but if it's a prayer with which you are not familiar, you can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session of study and practice to the benefit and liberation of all suffering beings. O Sanje Chudan Sochi Chonamla Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin Soji Be Sunam Ki Drola Pen Shir Sanje Drupasho. O Palden Sawelam Harimboche Tagi Chi War Pede Ten Shula Kadrin Jembo Gone Che Sunte Kusun Tugging Utrup Sal Duso. Okay, thank you. Oh, good. I'm having one of those days, and maybe you've had a day like that, where I reach into my bag and I find bills that I haven't mailed yet and an old Christmas card. What happened? All right. But I also found my books. If you remember the last time we talked, I took some suggestions for upcoming talks, and one of the suggestions came in the form of a request to explain one of the mind training slogans of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And so that's what I'm going to do today. Last time I explained one of the relative bodhicitta slogans, which was drive all blame into one. And then today I'm going to explain one of the ultimate bodhicitta slogans, see all phenomena as being dreamlike. So we should have some fun. If you remember from the talk last time, we talked about bodhicitta as being a central practice of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Someone asked me recently to outline the teachings and practices of Tibetan Buddhism in just a short few sentences. They obviously knew that I like to go on. And I said, well, the name of our home monastery is Karma Triyana Dharmachakra, and the name of our center is Karma Teksum Choling. Both names mean the same thing. The monastery's name is Sanskrit, and our name is Tibetan. But the Triyana or Teksum means the three vehicles of Buddhist practice, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. And so if you wanted me to summarize the three yanas, the practice and study of our center, it would be to summarize the three yanas, which are our vehicles of study and practice. But that would take so long. It would take a series of lectures to describe all of that. So today I'm just going to speak briefly about this and say that the Buddha taught that we are all caught in a world of suffering that he called samsara. And we are mired in samsara, stuck in samsaric suffering because of clinging and fixation. And that if we wish to be free from suffering, we need to find a way to let go of clinging and fixation. All of our favorite types of clinging and fixation. Favorite types of mine are clinging to things, places, people, situations. How many times have you said, I don't like this situation I am in? So I'm clinging to the situation not being what I want, et cetera, et cetera. So those are all of the things I cling to. And when I cling to people, things, situations, whatever, I suffer. As Pema Chodron, the 20th century wonderful 20th century woman teacher said, if something hurts so much, it's because I'm holding on so tight. Therefore, all of the practices of Buddhism are about letting go, learning how to let go of clinging and fixation. And there are three types of that instruction: Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. The names are big, but the practices are simple. Hinayana, yana means vehicle or path. Hinayana is the path of individual freedom. In other words, freeing ourselves from suffering individually. It consists of ethics and morality, as well as mindfulness. So Hinayana is ethics and morality and mindfulness. And these two go together, because when we're mindful and we learn to meditate, we become aware of our thought processes, sometimes for the very first time. And as a friend of mine once said, I used to think I was pretty compassionate until I started meditating, and then I began to see how uncompassionate my everyday thoughts were from moment to moment to moment. Oh, that person's bad, or this thing is bad, or that thing is bad. And so ethics follow upon mindfulness. Why? Because we try our best to do what the Buddha asked, which was do no harm, practice virtue, and tame our minds. The Buddha really summarized his path very easily. Don't harm yourself and others. Take good care of yourself and benefit others, and tame the mind, because then you'll know the difference between benefit and harm. And so the practice of the Hinayana is about gaining that mindfulness, which then allows us to be more ethical. Because if you can see your thoughts coming a mile away, then you can begin to work with them. If you can't see them coming, you'll get sideswiped, and then it's going to get a little ugly. So that's why we teach shamatha as our entry-level practice. Shamatha means calm abiding. It's the form of meditation where we allow our attention to rest on the breath as it comes and goes. And as we let our attention rest on the breath as it comes and goes, we cultivate mindfulness and awareness. Mindfulness, which is establishing the thread of our attention, and awareness, which helps us notice when we've wandered off and helps us to come back. So that's basic shamatha, basic practice for the Hinayana. But that's not the final practice, because if we want to let go of clinging and fixation, we eventually have to address what some people might call the elephant in the room. The thing we cling to the most, which is our sense of self. As the great philosopher once said, my way or the highway. That part of us that feels that somehow our method is better, somehow our thoughts are better, somehow our way of living is better, and everybody else just has to recognize that. Because of this tendency of all human beings to think that they are the central character in their own novel or movie. What do you mean, I'm not the central character? At any rate, because of this tendency of human beings to see themselves as the star of their own personal narrative, this is going to be the biggest of all of our clinging and fixation to try to work with. And so we have to be, shall we say, creative. Some people may say creative, some people may say sneaky. Whether it's creative or sneaky, we have to find a way to approach self-fixation and get that fist of self-fixation to let go. Many of you will have met the great teacher, Garchen Rinpoche. His center is over in Dayton. He talks about our self-fixation as being like an ice block in our heart. It's a block of ice, and it has to melt in order for us to feel warm-hearted toward ourselves and warm-hearted toward others. And so we teach the practices of warmth, loving kindness, and compassion as the Mahayana path, as our second practice. Hinayana is, what is it? Self-liberation. Okay, what are the two techniques?
Ethics,
okay. And mindfulness. Okay, very good. Ethics and mindfulness. And shamatha is the practice. We're going to have to go over this again. Okay, what are the two main things taught in the Hinayana? Ethics, and what's the other one? Mindfulness. All right, and how do we practice that? Through the practice of? Got it. All right, you're doing really well. Then in the Mahayana, we practice what's called bodhicitta. Anybody know what bodhicitta means? The awakened heart. That's right. Bodhicitta. Bodhi means what? Awakened. Citta means what? Mind or heart. That's right. So in the Mahayana, we're trying to learn bodhicitta, the awakened heart or the awakened mind. And this is how we're going to liberate ourselves from that ice block or that clenched fist, however, whatever image works best for you, of self-fixation. Because selfishness cannot live in an atmosphere of love. And this is, I guess you could say, it's our secret weapon against self-fixation. Remember I said you either have to be creative or sneaky, or both. And so when we teach love and compassion for ourselves and love and compassion for others, we begin to melt the ice block of our selfishness and begin to practice some warmth toward ourselves and others. And that's liberating. I've had several people tell me that as they've practiced love and compassion, that they have become more soft toward themselves as well as more soft toward others. And I don't mean soft in a kind of wimpy, not so useful way, but soft into the ways of not becoming inflamed with anger when people do things that we don't like. Impatience is a real problem for me personally. And so what I have to do is I have to continuously remind myself that I need to be warm-hearted and kind and understanding toward everyone, and that helps me with my impatience. So, the Vajrayana is our third method. And the third method consists of relating to our Vajra nature, our indestructible nature, Vajrayana, our indestructible path, which deals with our Buddha nature. The Buddha taught that we all have a mind that has the capability of awakening and becoming a Buddha. That's wonderful, but how do we get there? We start by having ethics and morality and mindfulness. We soften our self-clinging and self-fixation, which is the greatest of all of that is keeping us away from awakening, by practicing love and compassion. And then finally, we relate to our own basic nature that's called Buddha nature by imagining for a short time that we are actually a finished product, a Buddha. Those of you who attend our Tuesday night Chenrezig practices, 7 o'clock, Tuesday nights, be here. Those of you who attend our 7 o'clock Tuesday night Chenrezig practice or our 10 a.m. first Sunday practice of Chenrezig, we imagine that we become Chenrezig and recite his mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, as a way of cultivating a Buddha mind through the symbolism of mantra and visualization. And so our practices here are laid out pretty clearly. Shamatha is our Hinayana practice. Tonglen, or the practice of developing bodhicitta, is our Mahayana practice. And mantra and visualization is our main Vajrayana practice. There are other Vajrayana practices too, such as the practice of Mahamudra meditation, but that's a best topic for another day. So the slogans that we were talking about are our Mahayana approach. The way we work with selfishness to try to counteract our selfishness is through developing love for ourselves and love for all beings. But how do we do that? Well, we have to use our imaginations at first. At first, it may be difficult to have compassion for other people because, after all, they are only the ancillary characters in our personal story. And they can aggravate us from time to time. But the other person we may not have compassion for is ourselves. We may be overly demanding of ourselves. We may demand perfection of ourselves. We may drive ourselves too hard. If we did to another person what we do to ourselves, we might be arrested. The point of the matter here is that maybe the person we need to develop compassion for is ourselves. And so the practices of bodhicitta help us to do that. If you remember the practice of Tonglen, it's sitting in meditation and on the out-breath sending love to all beings. And on the in-breath removing their suffering. And as that suffering touches us, it dissolves into nothing and disappears. And on our out-breath, we give goodness again. And by doing this practice over and over, we slowly train ourselves to have a new reaction when things occur to us. And that's what we described when we talked about the slogan, derive all blame into one, when we talked about that last week. But I was asked this week to talk about the other half of bodhicitta, which is an understanding of the nature of mind and an understanding of the nature of all things. Simple topic. So what I'm going to do today is just briefly describe the Buddhist idea about the nature of mind and the nature of all things. The slogan they wanted me to explain was, see all phenomena as being dreamlike. Tough, tough, tough. But what it can tell us, it can tell us something about ourselves that we learn when we first start meditating. So let's just go back to shamatha. You're sitting in shamatha and you're attempting to watch your breath. A breath comes in, a breath goes out. We're doing well. We're watching it go in and we're watching it go out, and then suddenly, ding, 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 ding. Something happens. It's not that your cell phone rings. No. It's that you have this memory of something that happened yesterday and you're not happy about it. And it brings up all of those feelings from that argument that you had with somebody you were close to, and it all starts to roil up within you. And you get a little bit angry and you get a little upset. And so the method of shamatha is, at that moment, to use the technique of touch and let go. You touch the thought with your attention because you recognize that you are no longer doing shamatha. You're no longer with your breath. You're back in yesterday. You've been hijacked. You've been picked up and set down in yesterday and feeling all of those same things again. And so you use your attention. You touch the thought lightly. You can even label it thinking. Let go of it with a conscious intent, and then intentionally bring your attention back to the breath for a fresh start. Now, I will see what you guys think about this. Where did that thought that you just let go of, where did it go? Anybody have a guess they want to? Yes? Yeah. It lacks a fixed address. It disappeared, in other words. Okay. Anybody else have a thought about that thought? Yes? Same place. The same place that dreams go. All right. You're on to something. Thank you for that segue. I really appreciate that. Because that's really the case. We have an example right here in this example of meditation of what thoughts are. They're momentary things that arise and look as though they are something. And when we let them go, they disappear. Their disappearance is so common and everyday to us that we don't see what a big deal that really is. The fact that when we let that thought go, it disappeared, isn't that what they do? But we never took the moment to think about what the significance of that is. The significance of that is that it was never anything more than just a momentary flash, even while it was appearing. Even while it was appearing, it was nothing really. And so when it disappeared, it's also showing that it was nothing really. And what's interesting about it is that for that moment that it appeared with all of its force, it was, after all, the memory of an argument I had with somebody yesterday that made me really mad. With all that force, even with all that force, it was never anything more than just a thought. Wow. Does this mean there's no main character and no narrative? Whoa, that's a little too much. It's a little too much. So let's just go back to the experiencer. We can't see the experiencer. We give them a name, me. The person that had that experience, we give a name to, me or I. And it kind of helps keep us rooted in space, you know. It also prevents us from playing in traffic, which is dangerous. Just because I'm talking about emptiness, no one is authorized to go and play in traffic. Please do not do that. But what this means, though, is that our self-definition is continuously in motion. Because the thoughts that we have, even the momentary ones, are what we use to identify ourselves and to create the identity of I or me. And so the fact that those momentary thoughts are what we use to artificially concoct an idea of I or me, it's at first a little bit disturbing. But then it could actually be a little bit empowering, because this means that if we choose more kind and loving thoughts, we could be a more kind and loving person. And our experience would be different. Because as everybody knows, when we are acting out of anger, we may feel momentarily powerful, but then afterwards we realize that we've really kind of hurt ourselves a little bit with that anger. And we've maybe made people upset with us with the things we did while we were angry. So anger and its aftermath are painful. Whereas generosity and love don't have quite the same signature in memory. So in any case, the idea here is that for that moment that ugly thought appeared, we were captured in the world of that thought. We took momentary rebirth, if you will, in the world of that thought. And for that moment, we were there. And then, when we let go of it, we ceased being there. And so this is the theoretical background to the slogan, "Think of all phenomena as being dreamlike." Because it's not that all phenomena is dream. It's not that. Because then we would be able to play in traffic and nothing would happen. So it's not like that. The idea is that the experiencer is experiencing thoughts in a moment-to-moment way, the same way a dreamer experiences their dreams. In dreams, we may be talking with someone, and then suddenly we're eating our lunch, and then suddenly we're flying, and then suddenly we're hitting the ground. All of these things happen without seeming plot, without anything seeming to be going on. But they're happening in our mind. When we awaken, we realize that none of those things happen, which is really great, because I really didn't want to buy a boat. You know, but the idea is that when we awaken, we realize that they weren't real. But what's so fascinating is that the majority of the things that arise in our mind from day to day, from moment to moment, also have no cohesive plot. And they just arise and disappear. We put a plot on them. We sort of paint a plot on them by saying, I and me. This is happening to I and me. This is part of my narrative, and so forth and so on. So what I find fascinating about this slogan is that it reminds us to, from time to time, consider that the things that are happening in our mind are just happening in our mind, and that our body is conveying information, but it's our mind that really experiences it. And by recognizing this, we have the potential to remake our experience in a kinder, gentler, more loving way. Because if our thoughts really are moments in time, and they disappear even as they are rising. I mean, the Buddha compared the mind to an ocean with waves on it. The waves look separate from the ocean, but they're never separate from the water. Even as they rise, they're falling apart and changing. And this is how it is for us. By recognizing this, even just intellectually, this is not necessarily something that we're going to get at a deep level right away. But even just entertaining the notion of it, entertaining the notion that things may not be what they seem and that our reaction to them is everything, this is actually somewhat comforting in that this means that all of our life can have meaning to it. The meaning we add when we add love and compassion into our life. And so, if we can look at this world as being like a dream, not that it literally is, but that it's like a dream in that it is all our mental experience, then we can get with what Shakespeare said in Hamlet when he said, "Nothing is either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so." And so that's a brief explanation of the mind training slogan, "Think of all phenomena as being dreamlike." Once again, to summarize, the things that arise in our mind, whether they're thoughts, feelings, or emotions, are all happening in the mind. They are all happening in the mind. Our experience of this room right now is happening in our mind. Yes, we did adjust the temperature, which was helpful. But the skin is not thinking. It's warm. The skin doesn't think. Our mind thinks. The skin conveys the information, but the mind is what forms an idea about it. And that mind is a progressive thing that is always moving and always changing. When I was young, I love to be warm, but now that I'm a little older, being warm is a very complicated thing. So, anyway, how I think about the warmth is also going to change, and how I experience that warmth is also going to change. It's all happening in my mind. And again, this is liberating, because many people are oppressed by the things they think, especially the things they think over and over and over again. I frequently tell the story of the man that I met who said, "I have this continual thought that everything I do will fail." I've told this story many times. And I said to him, "But you have a great job. You have a wonderful family. Your wife loves you. You have a beautiful child. Everything is going well." And he said, "Yes, I know. Yes, I know, but I can't stop thinking this." And I said, "Well, did you ever consider that maybe it's just a habit of thinking that you have fallen into that may or may not have a basis in fact?" And he got this look on his face of fear, like, "Oh my gosh, do you mean I have to let go of my self-definition?" He looked terrified. And so I said, "You don't have to give it up today. I will not make you give it up today. But I will invite you to consider that perhaps the thought, everything I do will fail, is a thought you have had so many times that you think it's true, but that it may actually not have any basis." And he breathed deeply and then went into an interview with Kempo Carter Rinpoche, where he said the exact same, told exactly the same story and heard a very similar piece of advice. And he came out, and I didn't get to see him when he spoke afterwards. But afterwards, we did discuss it, and he said, "I think he gave me a pointing out instruction, pointing out the nature of my mind through this thought that I can't get rid of." And I said, "He's a genius." He just asked him to drop it for a second in his presence. And he experienced that thought differently. This is the power of great lineage masters, to help us see something differently just for a second. We have to work the rest of the way, but it's one of the blessings of being connected to great lineages that have in them these great masters who can help us. So thank you for your for asking for this particular instruction on think of all phenomena as dreamlike. And I'm going to give you homework. Sometime this week, you may have an experience, and I want you to note about this experience. It's going to be, let's put it this way, if your life is like my life, you will have this experience at some point this week. You will have a morning where everything goes wrong. You pick something up, you drop it. You pick it up again, you drop it. You go to pick it up again and you kick it farther away from yourself. Or the toilet will leak and you can't fix it. Or the toilet won't leak and you can't fix it. Or all of these things, or you go to work and this goes wrong and that goes wrong and this goes wrong and that goes wrong. The homework assignment is to take a moment, when you have this circumstance arise for you and say to yourself, huh, this is just like a bad dream. Because that's kind of what's happening. It's just a bunch of random stuff that we have identified or have defined as something bad in our life, when it's just a bunch of things that's happening. And it is, it's just like a bad dream where the one thing goes wrong and another thing goes wrong and another thing, and the dog ate your homework and the whole thing, right? So that might be a good piece of homework for you to do. And see if that changes. It might not. Your mileage may vary. So this may have no bearing on how you experience that series of bad events. But then you also may have a morning where everything goes right. Somebody actually made breakfast or coffee for you. Or you found, whoopee, that you had some leftovers, something to eat. Or something like happens at work and you have like one praise coming after another from the boss, and you're like, oh my gosh, it's just like a good dream. That's your assignment, is to sort of see how we define things as good or bad, and then how we can feel when we understand that and learn how to let it go. So that's your homework. I will be checking back with you. I'll be returning, and I'll be giving the Dharma talk. I think I'm giving the Dharma talk the last Sunday in January. I've given the first two Dharma talks here in January, and I think we have a five Sunday month. I think anyway, it was either last month or this month. Anyway, I'll be back, and then I'll check with you how your homework went. If you like to, you can write it down. Kind of write down your experience, and I'll be delighted to have some people share their bad dreams, and I mean the ones while you're awake, that happen when we come back. In the meantime, Meditation Instructor Corps will be presenting Dharma talks on Shamatha meditation starting next week for the next two Sundays. And if Shamatha is part of your life, and you are trying, like me, to incorporate it into your everyday life, and you have some struggle with it, bring your struggles, and I will all talk about them. In addition, I'm also reminding everyone that the Nyungne retreat will be the third weekend in January with Lama Tom over at Saints Peter and Paul, and you can see me after for details about it. And I think there's some time for questions. And the question microphone is operating. So if anybody has questions and so forth, come on up. Yeah, you can get in line, and we'll ask one after the other. Hey, how you doing? Long time no see. Yeah.
I got a question.
Sure.
I got two questions.
Sure. Well, we can get through one. Okay. We'll see.
Okay.
We got.
Well,
okay.
I just asked.
All right.
I noticed that, like, when I get, well, in certain predicaments with certain people.
Yeah.
I noticed that, like, my character is like a tiger mm-hmm. sitting in the grass in mm-hmm. my mind just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever something get triggered, it just come out full-fledged.
Mm-hmm.
And I really can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do notice that I'm in the background of my mind watching.
Right.
So it's like, in a way, it's another personality that just is
waiting
behind. And mm-hmm. then when it gets triggered, it take over.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's done doing what it do, it reside back. And then
mm-hmm.
My normal self come out, and I'm like, oh, shit, I didn't want to do that. I hurt myself. I shouldn't have did this. I shouldn't
right.
have that. And I'm just trying to understand how I get control of that aspect of myself.
Right.
Because I do notice that it's
right.
getting out of control.
Right.
And I don't want to let it, get
yeah.
accelerated.
You know, I tell you what, I'm sorry, I did forget your name.
It's Diamond.
Diamond. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fantastic. I'm glad to see you. But, I really appreciate you bringing this, because I suffer from a similar thing to this. I don't know if I'm more tiger or kitty cat, but I can't decide. But the claws still hurt, right? And you're right. When we lose our temper and when something happens, it's almost the reaction time is so fast, we don't know how to get in there and change it. We hurt somebody, we get triggered, we hurt them, and then we go, oh my gosh, what have I done, right? It's kind of like that. And I think the first thing is to, from my point of view, is to slow the process down for yourself occasionally by doing some quiet sitting meditation on a daily basis. If you can't do it every day, do it a couple times a week, whatever. Because what will happen is that as you work on your meditation, the tiger may actually show up in your meditation, meaning that your anger may arise in your meditation in a very small form. And then if you can deal with it in the small form, then that's going to be a good start of dealing with it in the bigger form. But I think in the end, making a very strong aspiration, saying, I am going to tame the tiger. I'm going to tame him and make him work for me. Not that he's out of control. You see what I'm saying? I'm going to tame it. Make that strong aspiration in the morning. This came from Kempo Carter Rinpoche's teachings, because he said anger is so easy. We do it and we choose it, and we have to choose something different. He said, so part of what you have to do is you have to make it harder to choose. And first is you make a promise to yourself. I am not the kind of man who is going to be like that. You say that to yourself in the morning. Now, you'll mess up. Bottom line, you will mess up. But at the end of the day, Rinpoche's advice was, at the end of the day, you come back and you say, I'm going to do it differently tomorrow. Because what this is that you're becoming like an older sibling to yourself. Because sometimes we need somebody to help us be strong. And so in a way, you're becoming that person for yourself by making the promise, I'm going to tame that tiger. End of the day, how'd I do? He got out of control here and here. But over here, he was good. So I rejoice in the goodness, and I'm going to do better on the other tomorrow. Does that make sense? So I think the other thing is taking responsibility and being honest with yourself. Have to be honest with yourself. And say to yourself, don't say, oh, it was that other person's fault that this happened. Because a lot of what happens is that we let ourselves get out of control because we blame the other person. Oh, they made me mad. But when in reality, they poked us and we went, wah. You see what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
And another aspect of that question, too.
Sure.
Is like, oh, like become. So I've been like studying a lot of neurology and archetypes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I just noticed I've become so damn aware of my mind
mm-hmm.
that like it's literally like sometimes throughout the day when I'm just doing regular stuff, it's literally like I got different aspects of me that's like
got
there
it.
And talking. And I don't really interact because it's normally just mood.
I hear that.
So I'm like, how do I try to make an amendment with it, like an agree? To get all aspects of myself together that
mm-hmm.
I am becoming super aware of, or do I mm-hmm. just like, start whipping?
Right.
And then,
Yeah. No, I hear that. I hear that. I think it's got to be a combo. From my point of view, a combo approach might be better. First, you got to restrain the tiger, right? Okay, all these aspects, got to restrain them a bit. But at the other hand, on the other hand, you can start to feed what is good within yourself. Feed what's good within yourself, where you connect. See how other people suffer. That is, I think, going to be really helpful. Because if you see really clearly how other people suffer, not just as a result of what you've done, but of they keep hurting themselves, right? And you see when they suffer, you can say, man, I want to help that. So you can kind of look for people who are like you, who struggle, and then reach your hand out to them and try to help them. And that, to me, is the bodhisattva path. What they call in Buddhism the bodhisattva path. You're trying to work on your own compassion and kindness for yourself and compassion and kindness for other people. So it's not just that you're restraining the tiger, but you're also feeding the part of you that is integrating all of this. Because that the loving, kind, compassionate, straightforward person, that's the person you're trying to become. You feed that person. Did you ever hear it? Somebody told me about this Native American story about the two wolves inside a person. There's the one that attacks and the one that is compassionate and giving and like a leader. You have to feed the good one and not feed the one that's bad. So the idea is that we have to learn how to feed what's good within us. And so that's kind of where I would go, is when you see the suffering of other people, make the aspiration, in the future, when I pull all this together, may I help that person. May I be the person who goes and puts a hand out to them, because they need a hand up. See, what's really good about your situation, what's bad about your situation is that you're aware of all your thoughts, and so that you think of them as all different, but they're all coming from your mind, which is actually unitary. Your experience may be a little fragmented, but you're you, and you have the potential to become a Buddha. And so that's the best I can do today. But I'll bet you there's some other people here who may be able to tell you some things, too, from their experience. I appreciate you coming up.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you for your teaching today, Lama Kathy. This may be a fairly basic question, but as I plan out my mindfulness workouts for the year, on the physical body, like I know I need to mix up strength training and cardiovascular.
Sure.
On the points that you touched on today, what's a good mix of shamatha, tonglen, mantra? Especially knowing that, I feel like I need the most work on the shamatha.
Right. Yeah. This will also help Diamond too, okay? His question will help you as well. Because I think the best way to do it is start with shamatha. Start with some shamatha breath awareness. Just start there. If shamatha is difficult for you, then you might start with a mantra recitation, such as the compassion mantra. Good medicine for the tiger, by the way. Om Mani Padme Hum. Just reciting the name of Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum, and putting your mind on that. And if you like a melody, sing it with a melody. You know, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, and so forth. Or if those two things don't work out so well for you, then use your imagination to send on the out-breath goodness to others and to receive and to remove their negativity on the in-breath, which is Tonglen. I would say that at the very least, it would be good to do some shamatha every day to establish mindfulness, because it's kind of like what Diamond's talking about. If he was unaware of his thoughts, this would be way worse, because he'd be thinking it's all everybody else's fault. But here he's seeing his part, which is good. So we see the part that we can control slowly by doing shamatha. So that's a good start. Then I would definitely do at least a little bit of Tonglen every day. And I tell people to, if they have prayer beads, to look at their prayer beads and take them like in a quarter, you know, like 20-something. In-breath, out-breath, move a bead. In-breath, out-breath, move a bead. Do that much Tonglen, breathing out goodness to yourself and others, and breathing in and removing the suffering from yourself and the suffering from others, also a good thing. And for Diamond's question, as you breathe in, remove your own negativity, and as you breathe out, give yourself healing from that. That will also help with the previous questioner. And do at least that. And then if you have extra time, you can do mantra, like when you're driving your car. I've met so many people who say they have road rage problems and that they end up doing Om Mani Padme Hum while they're driving. So I would say Om Mani Padme Hum would be good to do then too. But there are different kinds of people. That may be the best workout for you, but it might not be the best workout for somebody else. Like I met a woman who said, no way can I do shamatha. It's just my mind is bing, 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 boing, boing, boing. You know, it just like bounces off the walls. So for that person, I recommended that she chant Om Mani Padme Hum out loud with a melody just so she could hold her mind on the melody and the mantra for, you know, the quarter mala. And then to just let her mind rest a bit and then to do it again, let her mind rest a bit. And this is why I think that what we do here at KTC is so powerful and unique. It's because it's not like cookie cutter. It's like whatever a different individual needs, that would be the best.
Okay, and in general, so in summary, I can combine a little bit of that in a single cushion period as opposed to trying
absolutely
to go 3 days a week to shamatha, 2 days to...
Yeah, I think that if it's okay for you and if it's not too chaotic for how you approach meditation, I actually think that it's like taking vitamins. It's probably good to have shamatha every day, tonglen every day, and mantra when you have time. Okay, yeah, all right. Yeah, good. This will be our last question. Hey, Michael.
Hi, love. Kathy, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming up.
Thank you for your teaching.
Yeah.
I've noticed that when you're sitting on the mat, or even in regular everyday life, that you can put you start thinking, little seeds are planted in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it grows and it grows. I mean, you could be thinking about your boss.
Or, right.
You know, and then you're thinking, well, on Monday, when I get back, I'm going to say this to this person, and this is how it's going to react.
Right.
You're actually showing how you're actually making the person react.
Mm-hmm. It right.
Isn't true. And then I just find myself in thinking about other things. And it just piles up and piles up. So I did the other day, I looked at myself and I said, this isn't even real.
This is what?
This isn't even real.
This isn't
this,
even real. Okay.
It's not even a situation.
I get it.
It's
yeah.
Making these scenarios in my head.
Yeah.
And it went away.
Right.
And it's gone.
Uh-huh. I know. Yeah. I can't thank you enough for sharing this story because I'm going to repeat bits of it to see if I heard it properly in case people didn't hear on the PA system. What you're saying is that that you frequently would work scenarios out for conversations such as with coworkers and things like that, and then you would go into the situation and have this. And then at some point you realized that it was kind of a foolish thing to try to have those conversations in advance, like I'm going to do this and they're going to do this and I'm going to do this and then, because yeah, okay. And then when you let go of that technique of trying to control things, it like disappeared and it hasn't come back. Okay, yeah, that kind of stuff will happen. And this to me, I mean, it doesn't happen for everybody and it doesn't happen necessarily decisively. It could be that when life events arise in your life that are really intense life events, then the worrying and the pre-thinking will come back. But what's really interesting is they won't last as long because you haven't been feeding them. You see what I'm saying? I experienced something very similar to this in my own life. I like to worry, and I had championship worriers in my family. My grandmother, her mother, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother, championship worriers. They showed me how to do it as an expert. Okay, but what's really weird is that after a certain point of time, I just couldn't do it. It was just exhausting. It was exhausting. And so when I started meditating, I began to worry less because I was able to interrupt the worry by saying, this isn't even real. And Kempo Rinpoche, my teacher, he would try to help me. He said, do you realize that the majority of the things you worry about never happen? And he said, you can't live your life in fear. He told me that once, just out of nowhere. Okay, Rinpoche, I get your message. You know, so slowly, slowly. And then one day I was actually at work and I looked up from my job. I was sitting in the copy desk, C-O-P-Y, copy desk, writing newspaper headlines. And I said, I don't feel bad anymore. Wow. And I went to Rinpoche and I said, I think this meditation stuff works. And he said, no, you're just becoming more mature. Way to go, Rinpoche. But I think that's what it is for us, that after a while, the investment that we make in trying to control things just doesn't pay off. And then and it's like the good wolf, bad wolf thing that we were talking about. You know, when you feed the tiger, you get a big tiger. If you feed the opposite of that, the kindness, the understanding, the strength that is patience, when you feed, patience is strength, believe me. It is absolutely strength. If you feed that, then that's what you have, that quiet, gentle strength that is inspiring to other people. So I don't know that you had a question, but I'm all down with that. Okay, yeah, thank you. I'd say keep going. Keep going. Because we have to, you know, I really appreciate you sharing that. That's why we're here, you know. You remember the three jewels of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Then, yes. Oh, did you have a question? Okay. A Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. A Buddha is the teacher, the Dharma is our path, and the Sangha is our community. And the Sangha is really powerful in that we all sit together like this, and even though we may not have all the answers, we can help one another, and that's a powerful thing. So I thank you for bringing your sincerity and goodness to us today. Let's sit quietly for a moment and dedicate the goodness of our session. We dedicate the goodness of our session to all beings who suffer and all beings who struggle and all beings who are trying to improve their lives. May they be able to strengthen what is good within them, to melt the ice block of self-fixation and clinging, and become liberated from the suffering of samsara. And becoming liberated, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Go out and watch your everyday dreams.